So our reading today is from Mickey Cashcan, who is one of my key teachers. She is committed to nonviolence, studied nonviolent communication with Marshall Rosenberg, who founded those concepts and those ideas. And not only the reading, but really the bulk of the sermon is her ideas that have inspired me so, and that I know she wants to be spread far and wide. So I am doing my piece to do that today. Mickey says, "Love thrives in the context of freedom and belonging. Love shrinks in the context of obedience and shame. Love is intertwined with gifting and thus withers away in transactional contexts. From this perspective, I boldly claim that our survival depends on finding ways to preserve love, and that this entails putting human needs at the center. Ultimately, I don't see any way of fully turning around the march to destruction without focusing on connection in all its dimensions, self, others, nature, and life. Connection with self manifests as full freedom. Connection with others manifests as belonging. Connection with nature manifests as trust in natural abundance. And connection with all of life manifests as care for the whole." The theme for December here at WOOF is awe. And when I think about experiencing awe, I can take myself out of normal time and think about time universal. And I'm quickly in awe. And so I want to open with portions of a poem by the theologian Matthew Fox. "A billion years of stewing and stirring, and the gifts of hydrogen and helium birthed galaxies, spinning, whirling, alive galaxies created trillions of stars. One of those supernova gifts exploded in a special manner, sending a unique gift to the universe, which later coming creatures would one day call Earth, their home. Its biosphere was also a gift, wrapping it with beauty and dignity and just the right protection from sun's radiation and from the cosmic cold. This gifted planet was set as a jewel in its most exquisite setting, in this case, the exact distance of 100 million miles from its mother star, the sun. New gifts arose, never seen in such forms in the universe. Rocks, oceans, continents, multicellular creatures that moved by their own inner power. Life was born." And so here is Earth as we know it today. And if we think about the timeline, which is an awesome timeline, way too big for us to understand, that Earth came to be, we could imagine a 24-hour clock. So this is not like a typical clock face because it has the whole 24 hours of the day, starting at midnight, coming through to noon, and continuing through the day into the evening back to midnight. And you can see all the things that happened, some of which we heard about from Matthew Fox's poem. But what I want to point out is that humans didn't show up until it's 11:58 and 43 seconds. So, of course, this is just, you know, kind of incomprehensible, this scale and magnitude of time. So human beings, how did those human beings for most of that time live? They lived like we heard about in the story for the children this morning. Because we as human beings, we have what two scholars, Maturana and Vernon Zoller, talk about as the biology of love. That evolutionarily, we have evolved for love, for cooperation, for care, not into domination and submission. Because we evolved separately from the chimpanzees and formed a different lineage. So we're very closely genetically connected to chimpanzees, but we're also very different from chimpanzees. Because we carry the loving relationship of the infant into adulthood. So we continue to have this biology of love, this movement towards care. So the qualities of that kind of culture that existed for most of humanity and that still exists in very few places today is that mothering is central. So not mothers necessarily, but the acts of mothering, the mothering relationship, that focusing on needs and giving without expectation. And that cooperation was the norm. So some of the historians and anthropologists who study this talk about these as matriarchal societies, which I don't think is a great word because of a variety of reasons. The first being that it sets us up as kind of thinking, oh, matriarch is the same as patriarchal, but just with the mothers in charge rather than the men in charge. So it is not that. It is not about who rules, but it is about what is centered, and that the idea of mothering is centered. So perhaps matricentric would be a better way of talking about this. So there is not this stratification, this higher and lower between either genders or classes or even adults and children. It's about cooperation and the spirit of giving where things are needed. And there is a focus not on leadership and authority coming from some sort of position, but on natural authority. You all, you know people that you meet who just somehow exude natural leadership, natural authority, the kind of wisdom that you want to attend to. So that is where authority comes from. It kind of emerges naturally, and those are the people who step into leadership roles, and it could be way more than one person. And things are exchanged not through some sort of transaction, but things flow in a gift-oriented way towards where the needs are, like we heard about in the story. And these societies are nonviolent. They're peaceful. They're stable. People growing up in this way have trust for themselves because they're surrounded by direct love, by nurturing when they need it, by seeing that happening for others, and growing up without the kind of relational trauma that is unfortunately so common for how we live today. So I'm guessing this sounds sort of strange, right? Not normal, maybe not even natural. Yeah? But people, scholars that Mickey trusts, and I trust Mickey, affirm that it is this way and that there is a lot of evidence of it, including people living this way as best they can, even in the present. So if we think about Homo sapiens, so this is shorter than the little piece on the other clock, but how long you know, our direct Homo sapiens ancestors have been around, and how long what I'm going to call patriarchy, and I'm going to unpack that, has been around. The patriarchy didn't show up until 58.6 seconds into the full minute that this stopwatch is timing. So what happened to make, to have that become so, and it's been around for 7,000 years, so it feels like forever to us, right? And it's everything that's been written down, and it's in the once upon a time stories that we hear. So there are a few ideas about how this could have happened, and this is prehistoric, so we are using, you know, the hard evidence, meaning the things that could last, like bones and ceramic and stones, not the soft evidence, which of course there are a lot of soft things that were used that we'll never know about. But there are multiple things that could, it could have gone this way, and I want to present multiple ways to think about it. None of them are guaranteed, but I want you to be able to think, oh, I could see how that could have happened. So one of the things is that with agriculture, with starting to grow things, it started to become possible to accumulate things. So if you're just hunting and gathering, you can't really accumulate things because it's gonna spoil. So you kind of, you share everything as you have it so it doesn't spoil. But if you start to grow things and have dry storage, then you can accumulate. And if you're gonna accumulate, you could accumulate for the entire community, or you could decide to accumulate in a more separate way, where this is for me and my people. And if that accumulation starts to want to come through a father's line, a patrilineal line, the only way that a father could be sure of his line would be to control women to make sure that access to women is limited to only him so that he would then know his line. So this is some things that have unfolded that make patriarchy possible. Another thing that could have happened, according to Maturana and Verdun Zoller, who I mentioned earlier, is that some things just could have shifted a little bit that would have changed things. So, for example, it could have been that wolves and humans together kind of, you know, tracked and followed the same herd and shared access to that herd so that there was enough for the wolves and the humans. But if the humans somehow started to think, oh, we're going to get more. If we prevent the wolves from getting to these animals, then we will have access to more animals. So instead of trusting nature and the abundance of nature to provide for both, they interfere with wolves having access and gain some level of control and keep it all for themselves. Another scientist, anthropologist, Gettner Abendroth, thinks about it more about specific events that happen, so not when it's kind of drifted into being, but there were specific stressful and traumatic events, for example, like the flooding of the Black Sea. So it's not an accident that we have mythical stories about floods. Or desertification of lots of the land, that so the land could no longer support the number of the people who had come to rely on it. And so the men were forced to, so they had probably become accustomed to relying on agriculture. The men tried to hunt again more. It was inadequate. They couldn't feed themselves that way. So they moved westward towards Europe and encountered the peaceful egalitarian societies that were living there. And there wasn't enough. There wasn't room for them to settle because it was so dense, and so they had to make this difficult decision to turn their weapons not against animals, but against human beings. Because they could either return to the steppes and the desert that couldn't sustain them, or they could essentially invent war. So we can't really imagine the trauma of this, because the idea of killing humans is part of our everyday entertainment, right? I mean, murder mysteries, like no one really stops to think about the violence that happened in a murder mystery. We just want to solve the mystery. But if you can just kind of imagine how traumatic that would be to experience that trauma, that distress, the difficulty that led them to killing other people, that led them to taking over these peaceful societies, which the way that they partly know when this happened is that there were these specific types of graves that these people, the Kurgans, had, and they appeared in Europe for the first time. They could see when those appeared, and they contained men with weapons, and they were in nearly 700 different places where those settlements had been flourishing, living in this way that we spoke about earlier, for hundreds of years. So there's this serious trauma. These invaders are intermingling with the people that they have invaded forcibly. So they've got victims, they've got their own trauma, and so we can just think about, we're learning so much more about trauma and its effects on the brain these days in our current culture. It's not easy to recover from trauma, and in fact, there's an idea that it takes 4 generations to recover from trauma, but these people never had 4 generations to recover, right? Because the traumas just kept happening. People kept living in captivity. So it just became more and more, the trauma started to overtake the normalcy that had existed for so long within humanity. Mickey uses an analogy of cancer to kind of represent how patriarchy spreads. Because a persistent feature is that they push outward for more land, more resources, more labor, more markets, various reasons to keep going for more. And so once it's established itself in Europe, we know through colonization, empire, conquest, it really has become the global normal. So cancer cells, if you think about it, they take over a body, focus on their own survival at the expense of the body, and then they damage the body's system so much that the body dies. So it doesn't really make any sense, right? Because they're going to die with the body. And they actually have a way of coercing healthy tissue nearby to helping the cancer spread. And so that is the equivalent, if you will, of the kind of internalized oppression, the way that we all just, you know, agree to the system as it is. So certainly at some point there was enough power to coerce and to take things over, you know, in like the invasion, but there's not enough power now if you don't agree with it. And there hasn't been enough power for so long if there's not some fundamental agreement, some sort of internalized, this is how it is, and so of course I'm going to go along. So we can kind of get a sense of how it could have happened historically, and a sense of what it's like. Now, when I say patriarchy, I mean this way of being that focuses on scarcity rather than abundance, that focuses on separation from others, from nature, from animals, and this idea that we can control things, control what we fear. And that has come from this history that I've been telling you that is the history of patriarchy. But first, I want to introduce you to a fish. Look at this beautiful fish. It's a blue tang, who some of us know and love as Dory in the movies. But so here's a blue tang. And this blue tang lives in this tank. And so the boundaries of this tank are what this fish believes to be the boundaries of the whole world, and this artificially controlled pH balance and water temperature is what the fish believes always has been, always will be. The coral and the plants, that's all that exists. Those flakes that float down in regular intervals, that's the only food that exists. Are you blaming the fish for believing this? Because, of course, this is where the fish belongs, the Great Barrier Reef, with miles and miles of sea and all the variability that comes with living in the actual sea. But you're not mad at this fish, right? For its limited perspective, do you think the fish should feel guilty for swimming and believing all of this? So this is how I think about patriarchy, or how I think about the ideas that white people are supreme to other people, the ideas that white people are the norm, the ideas that men are the norm. So as I was researching some of this, I was looking at actually picture books, because I was trying to find a great image, and these prehistoric societies, like almost all the people in the pictures, really were men. Okay, this is like, there's not even half and half here. Like, and the people who are leading things, and the people who are telling the stories. So, I mean, you know, why would we think that women were in charge? But when I think about it this way, so in terms of privilege, I'm pretty high on the hierarchy. Really, the only thing I have going against me is that I'm a woman, and I'm getting to be perhaps an age that's old enough to be going against me. But the whole idea that we live in a white supremacist culture where whiteness is seen as supreme, that can feel uncomfortable for me. Until I recognize it's like this, it's like, oh, I'm just in the aquarium believing what I believe because what else do I know? So then I don't feel guilty for myself. I feel grateful for the knowledge. I feel grateful for recognizing, oh, wait a minute. This isn't how it has to be. So that's what I want, especially the men who hear the word patriarchy. My wonderful, enlightened husband, who is still in New York right now with his family, like, I could say patriarchy, and I see him go, it's not about men. It's about the system that is patriarchy. So I'm thinking that we can all agree that the system in which we live, in that system, in general, men have more access to resources, more access to respect and attention, more ease in attending to their needs. Not because men are bad, but because we live in a system, we have social concepts, we have habits of thinking, we've got practices, processes, institutions, structures that are external to us, and structures and roles that we have internalized. So this is like not a decision that we're making. The fish isn't deciding to live in that aquarium. The fish was placed in that aquarium. So patriarchy is not necessarily the rule of men, just like matriarchy is not necessarily the rule of women, but it's these principles of separation, of scarcity, of control. So it's like the father principle rather than that mothering principle. and we haven't been able to heal from the trauma that happened when men were forced by circumstances or eased themselves into controlling access of the wolves to a herd or something similar. And we live in this time where this is seen as normal, where these things that, like, we've lost access to the horror of violence, of murder. It's on, you know, it's part of our entertainment. So we've never healed from this trauma. Traumas continue to increase generationally and generationally. And what Mickey says is that essentially we are now living, it's not that we never had the possibility to be violent to others, but it was used only in the most extreme conditions. But now we live with some of these things that are biologically designed instead of the biology of love, which still exists but is fading. We have this biology that the extreme becomes normal. Three things that are typically would be extreme: the fight, flight, freeze response, coercion to make people do things through domination, and shame. So fight, flight, and freeze, we kind of have this idea that we return to some sort of reptilian brain, like we default into it. But with further study about brain research, part of our brain decides to give control to that more primitive brain so that it can focus because there's been an assessment of danger. And so then we move into fight, flight, freeze, some sense that we need to, you know, how are we going to handle this danger? We're in this state essentially constantly now, and then there are times where we're triggered into it being, you know, fully in it, but we're always in it partially. And it's easy to get us from that partial to full activation. Coercion. So, in general, there was no need for coercion in these societies where we relied on relationship and care for the whole and all the needs were being met. So you didn't, I mean, it just, everything was working. And so there was no need for coercion. But really because this way that we're living now, the scarcity with the control, with domination is unnatural. We have to use coercion to really make it work so that obedience becomes something that we want from our children. So that, essentially, that's the norm of parenting, right? If I ask you to, like, get up and do a quick improv of parenting, I think you're likely to do, okay, you get back to bed, right? Like, this is, like, our kind of, like, standard vision of parenting versus, like, oh, hey, sweetie, come here. Like, that's not what the improv actor would do first thing. But that is what our biology of love would have us do first thing. And then shame. So shame, again, in the time where we're living cooperatively and happily together, would be there to protect the group. Because we, as humans, we're vulnerable enough that we need to belong to a group. And if there is ever a time where the behavior of an individual threatened the group, then shame could be used in that extreme situation to protect the group from that individual that might endanger the group. But shame, pretty familiar emotion, yes? It's like enculturated into us. It's not used in extreme situations. It's used frequently. So what do we want, given that this is where we live and have lived such that we believe it to be the entire sea of how human beings live, when it's really an aquarium that is containing us? So what we hope for, what we talk about in Unitarian Universalist congregations all over the country and even all over the world, in India and in Transylvania, we want liberation for all, right? Now here's the thing. When we say liberation for all, we probably mean liberation for the good guys, right? The thing is, liberation for all includes everybody. So think of that person who you think is causing all the problems. It includes that person. So we do not want liberation for the 99%. We want liberation, the 1% gets to come too. We want liberation for all. Because when we want liberation for the good guys, liberation for the people who agree with us, liberation for the all the Unitarian Universalists, it's still separation, right? So we want liberation for all. But how do we get there when that is not where we naturally go? It was like liberation for all, but it's a spiritual practice. So Mickey has a vision. My vision is of a world based on restoring the mysterious, endless flow of energy and resources through generosity and willingness from where they exist to where they are needed. That is the way life cares for all that lives. My vision is of restoring connection with self, other, life, and nature through the practice of caring for needs at all levels. But that's not how we think about it. This is not how we think about leadership. And all of us need to be leaders to lead us out of this nightmarish situation that we find ourselves in, but we're actually concerned about the survival of the human species. So we keep talking about we want to protect planet Earth. I think Earth is going to be fine. I'm not sure that Earth is going to be fine for human beings, given all of the control that we have tried to take over nature, over burning fossil fuels, believing that we can have more. So the qualities of leadership that we need are not that direct, control, manage, supervise kind of ideas that are obviously embedded in the patriarchal world that we live in, but it's more leadership as the idea of having care and responsibility. So we want to think about interdependence. That we are inseparable from those we lead. We're all on the same boat, if you will, and we're right now we're at different levels on the deck. But we're all interdependent. And if we're going to do this, we're going to need help and support because it is countercultural. And how do we think about using whatever power we have in service of the whole, the all? How do we notice where we defer power, where we just assume, of course, they must know. Own your power. How do we get out of the either-or, right-wrong thinking and get really creative? How do we engage with open hearts, honoring ourselves and honoring others? And how do we be courageous and humble at the same time? The answers are not easy. I'm not sitting here telling you that I have the answers. But there is a huge question, and we have got to seek answers, and we've got to seek them in a different way. So we want to disidentify with the fish tank. We want to recognize that we are that beautiful fish who belongs in the Great Barrier Reef. And so how do we start to notice the fish tank? How do we disidentify ourselves with how we've been trained to think, how we've been trained to be, what we've been trained to do? In whatever sphere of influence we have, that might be in our family, that might be in the place where we work, that might be in the school we attend, whatever your sphere of influence, remember that you are that beautiful blue tang who is meant to swim in that beautiful, amazing, open sea, not in this tank. So see how much you can undo your socialization, where you can catch yourself, and notice where you can see the suffering of you, the suffering of others, the suffering of men in particular in this system. Can you imagine what it would be like to be free of fear, free of obligation, of should, free of habits that limit you? How can you tune into whatever is your biggest vision and pursue it little by little every day? This is Nikki's request of me and of all of us, if we are up for it. And I am still working my way to being up for it, and all the discomfort and the losses that would come with it. But the beauty of living in a world where we attend to all needs, the beauty of living in a microcosm in this big world where we attend to all needs, pulls me forward. And Nikki reassures us from her experience that there's no better game in town. So may we play this game and explore all that is possible.
Thank you, Leslie, for that thought-provoking talk.